This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support for our program. Matt Doyle is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757, wherever you are, 877-217-5757. Send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with one of the most remarkable people in American politics for the last couple of generations, former mayor of Cleveland, Dennis Kucinich, youngest mayor in U.S. history of a major city, also an eight-term congressman serving from 1997 to 2013, representing Ohio's delegation from the 10th District. He has written about one of his passions in the division of light and power, and we're going to start there, and we'll, of course, get an assessment from Mayor Kucinich about American politics and life as we know it today. But The Division of Light and Power is his book. It's a documented story of a courageous American mayor who fought and beat a utility monopoly, an epic battle involving corporate espionage, sabotage, co-conspirators from banks, extortion, political corruption, organized crime, mob-directed assassination attempts, congressional investigations, and media cover-ups. Now, who would that mayor be, Dennis Kucinich?
Good morning, Jim. Yes, the Division of Light and Power is my documented story of the efforts by a utility monopoly and their partners in the banking community to steal, literally steal, Cleveland's municipal electric system, which provided power to the people of Cleveland at 20% savings from the private utility monopoly. It was a battle royal.
It was a battle royal, and you were mayor when I was in college, so that was a long time ago. We were both young then, so why does that have relevance today?
Well, right now with the American Rescue Plan money that's coming into cities, at some point that money's going to run out. Some cities are expanding programs. Some are just hanging in to begin with because of loss of revenue after the COVID-19. And there's going to be tremendous pressure to privatize again. And the privatization of public-owned assets is a very risky business, because generally what it means is that people are going to end up paying a second time that which they paid for a first time, and the services they get are going to come at a higher price and not necessarily and generally not more efficient. So, this is really an important moment for America to understand. This book is a roadmap for defending the public's right to own electric systems, to own waterworks, to own parks and municipal services. And, did I know that 40-some years ago when this fight started? No. But actually it started in 1969. The book opens with a power outage in downtown Cleveland at Christmas time. And the reader then finds out how those outages kept occurring, and it is pretty shocking.
The Division of Light and Power is reviewed prominently by many journalists. One, Chris Hedges, the Pulitzer Prize winner, who's been with us, he says, like Robert Caro's The Power Broker, it is a gripping, moving, lucidly written account of the hidden mechanisms of corporate power in the U.S. and what happens when corporate interests are challenged. Now, there is a sentiment in our country that corporate is better than government in running everything. You don't share that sentiment, do you?
Well, I mean, the ultimate direction of that thinking is, kind of totalitarianism. People then don't have any real access to decision makers. Corporations make all the decisions. And the whole idea of a democratic the democratic experiment that we're in is that the people elect individuals. Those elected individuals are accountable, and the whole idea of government of the by the people, of the people, by the people, and for the people, is something that it's our legacy to be able to continue into effect. But that doesn't necessarily happen, and the idea of corporations are going to do what they need to do for their shareholders. Government officials have to represent everyone. And, if you have rule by corporations, that's not called a democracy. It's something else.
877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org for Mayor Kucinich. And We have a question from a listener. This is a good one from Hal listening in Monroe, Louisiana, asking about somewhat your legacy. You were known as a rabble rouser and a young man on the rise, and then got to Congress after being mayor, a major comeback, and 8 terms there. And Hal notes that you were there for the Clinton impeachment, and you were also there when we went to war. The United States did, under false pretenses, in Iraq. Do we have some examples based on your 16 years on Capitol Hill of government overreach?
Well, yes. I led the effort, led it in the Congress, to try to stop the U.S. from going to war against Iraq. Because what I said in a memo dated October 2nd, 2002, was which is available on the Internet, by the way, was that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, with Al-Qaeda's role in 9/11. Iraq didn't have the intention or capability of attacking the United States, and no one could find those weapons of mass destruction. And everything I said back then turned out to be 100% spot on, and instead our country wasted the lives of so many of our servicemen and women, those precious lives, killed about 1 million innocent people in Iraq, and blew about $6 trillion, as if, you know, we have that kind of money to waste. Also, I was chairman of an investigative subcommittee that brought forth a lot of the facts about the subprime meltdown, where the banks got bailed out, the American people, so many people lost their homes because of the games that were being played on Wall Street. And, you know, my approach was informed by what I learned in Cleveland and how to stand up and speak out. And the other thing is, when I first came to Congress, Jim, check this out. I sat on a committee which had oversight over the government. One of the first hearings I had, we found out the Department of Defense.
All right. I think we at least temporarily lost contact with Mayor Kucinich, and I'm sure we'll be able to get it back with our intrepid producer, Matt Doyle. Do we have?
Hello?
There we go. We got you back.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, sir.
So what I was saying is that I found out when I first came to Congress that the Department of Defense had over $1 trillion worth of spending they couldn't account for. I mean, government is famous for blowing money unless you keep an eye on it. I never am in a position where I'm saying, well, government is the font of all love, mercy, et cetera. No, you have to keep an eye on it. But there are certain things that government has a proper role in. And, you know, and that includes providing for the security of the people of the country socially, you know, making sure that people aren't going to be on the edge of a cliff all the time financially, mm-hmm. making sure there's jobs and that the infrastructure of a community is solid and that the school systems are funded and healthcare is funded. I mean, these are all things that are proper role for government.
All right, 877-217-5757. We've got some folks lined up to talk to Mayor Dennis Kucinich, former mayor of Cleveland, 16 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, and the author of The Division of Light and Power. Dan, downtown Baton Rouge, you're on with Mayor Kucinich. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Mayor, given his fight for the TVA, I take it that Nebraska Senator George Norris is one of your heroes?
What about
George Norris? Senator Norris was an outstanding member of the United States Senate. And he's somebody who I paid attention to. And I also want to say this, since I'm speaking on, you know, Louisiana Public Radio. When I was a child, I heard about the work of Huey Long in trying to rebuild the infrastructure of Louisiana and his commitment to the people. Now, there were unsavory aspects, to be sure, that were going on at the State House during the time that he was governor. But he focused on trying to lift up poor people and trying to make sure that government did produce some benefits for people. And I paid attention to that as a young person trying to see, well, you know, what is government's proper role?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there are some things that Long did that were important then and are important now to consider. You know, his whole idea about every man a king, the idea of sharing the wealth. Well, those are things that we need a more equitable distribution of the wealth.
All right. We're going to try to get a caller in, and it's David in Atlanta before we go to a break in a minute. David, you're on with Mayor Kucinich. Hi, David.
Thank you. It's an honor. You know, whenever you bring up the attack on the Capitol on January 6th to President Trump, he talks about Antifa and he talks about Black Lives Matter. I don't know of any acts of looting or rioting that Antifa or Black Lives Matter condoned or encouraged, but I do know their cause is noble. What was noble about attacking the Capitol of the United States to try to overthrow the government?
All right. What about January 6th? I'm sure you have some strong feelings, Mayor.
Well, you know, I served 16 years in the U.S. Capitol, and I was in Washington, you know, most of the time, day and night. And I love that place. You know, it's a revered place. And, you know, I mentioned Huey Long. There's a statue of Huey Long in where Congress first met, near the Capitol Rotunda. You know, I was horrified at what I saw happen.
Okay, we're going to get more from Mayor Kucinich on this, the author of The Division of Light and Power, and we're back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. A few more minutes with Mayor Dennis Kucinich, the author of The Division of Light and Power, 16 years in Congress, in addition to being mayor of Cleveland, youngest mayor of a major city in U.S. history, also elected to the city council in Cleveland in 1969 when he was 23. And after the mayor refused to sell Municipal Light, now Cleveland Public Power, the publicly owned electric utility, the Cleveland Mafia sought to murder him. A hitman from Maryland planned to shoot him in the head during a Columbus Day parade, but the plot fell apart when the mayor was hospitalized and missed the event. How close were you to the end in that tumultuous time, Mayor?
Well, listen, if I hadn't already believed in God before that incident, I sure believed in God afterwards, because had I been in that parade, I don't know if I'd be talking to you now. You know, what happened was I had a bleeding ulcer. I was rushed to the hospital. That's why I missed the parade. So, you know, the book really recounts, in some cases, the day-to-day unfolding of events that really tell a story of a 31. Keep in mind, I was only 31.
You were a young man.
I mean, imagine taking on City Hall from the inside.
Well, you were an active mayor, and there is word that you're running again. Is that true?
I am running for mayor again. I filed my petitions 2 days ago, and Cleveland's a different city now, less population, more poverty and crime, and I'm determined, as someone who's lived here all my life, to do my part around.
And before we hit the break, David in Atlanta asked about January 6th, and some people did get killed that day. We know that, but Mike Pence could have been killed. Nancy Pelosi could have been killed. How close of a call was that?
Well, look, you know, a mob takes on a characteristic of its own. But what people need to remember, you know, when I was in Congress, I served 16 years in Congress with people like Bobby Jindal, Rodney Alexander, Chuck Bustani Jr., Steve Scalise. I've known Steve for years, and Cedric Richmond. I mean, there's a lot of good people there, and we ought to try to get along and try to lower the temperature in this country right now and stop the polarization. I mean, you know, we're all Americans. We, you know, left, right, center, liberal, conservative. We have to remember that there's something that binds us first and foremost as Americans. We can never lose sight of that. And that always has troubled me when I see the, not only what happened in January, but when I see the
Mayor,
going on right now.
It is always a pleasure. It's been a few years, but great to catch up with you, and best of luck in your another comeback attempt for Mayor Dennis Kucinich, running for mayor almost a half century after he was first elected. So you're a brave man, and I commend you for your life in public service. Thank you, Mayor.
Well, thank you. Hope you get a chance to promote the book.
Thanks. Yes, indeed. The Division of Light and Power, an important book about what happened the first go-around when Dennis Kucinich was running Cleveland, Ohio. Let's talk again. Thank you. Good luck. And we're joined now by Chris Matthews, a voice and a face familiar to most Americans. He hosted Hardball with Chris Matthews on MSNBC for 20 years, and of course had a long and distinguished career as a print journalist and also was involved at in politics at high levels, working for House Speaker Tip O'Neill and for former President Jimmy Carter. And he's written about his life and times in this country, my life in politics and history. And good morning to you, Chris Matthews.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's good to talk with you, and that is a distinctive voice we're hearing. And let's start in reverse. You go about 300 pages before you start writing about Donald Trump in this book. And your life is, of course, a full one before Trump, but you knew him before he became president. And you note that there were often rumors and speculation that he would run, and then he finally did in 2016. And you had one of those seminal moments when you asked him about abortion and punishment for it. And I doubt that you've interviewed him since. What happened that night on Hardball?
Well, that was in Green Bay, Wisconsin, before the primary that year in 2016. And I had worked with my producer, Robert Zelliger, and we were trying to figure out who this guy was and what he didn't know but was pretending to know. And we sort of zeroed in on abortion rights because he had advertised himself as a pro-lifer. And I thought, that's interesting. It doesn't seem to fit with him and his big city sort of attitudes. And so I decided to find out if he even knew what he was talking about. So I asked him, should there be any punishment for a woman who chooses to have an abortion? And he paused for a while, and he finally said, yes, there has to be some form of punishment. I couldn't get any further with him, but you never knew. I mean, if you put him under truth serum, whether he would have gone further, it would be a $10 fine, 10 years in prison. Who knows what he was, where he was getting? But I think he realized he had gotten himself into trouble, and he sort of pulled back. But I thought it was a good example of what he was pretending to be, a conservative, a cultural conservative, and he really was nothing of the kind. So I thought that would have ruined him. Of course, a couple hours later, he put out the word that he didn't mean that. Well, I don't know what he meant. Of course he meant that, but he didn't know what he was talking about. But Trump told me a lot of what he told me in those interviews before he was a candidate suggested a certain character problem. He would say Bill Clinton could have gotten out of his trouble with Monica Lewinsky if he just took the Fifth Amendment and blamed everything on Ken Starr. But that showed a president of the United States would take the Fifth Amendment like a mobster or a communist sympathizer. Why would a president ever admit that whatever he said would incriminate him? That's a hell of an acknowledgement by a president.
Well, in retrospect, was not a surprise. And Trump, of course, is the preeminent person in American politics today, even though he's out of office. And you left Hardball. But one thing that is certain is that ratings were better under Trump. He kept things interesting, didn't he?
Well, I think he will. He certainly drove up the participation in the 2020 election. We had the largest total turnout in history, for and against him, obviously. He got 74 million votes, more than anybody before, and Biden got 81 million. And if he's a key player, as you suggest, in 2022, we're going to have a decent turnout. But that's hard to figure. It's hard to figure how will he ignite the anti-Trump vote as well as he ignites the pro-Trump vote. I'm not sure which way it's going to go next time. I know a lot of young people and minority people who don't always vote voted in 2020 to get rid of Trump. Will they be as energized to try to throw him back out of politics if he portrays himself as a major figure in the November election next year?
The book from Chris Matthews is This Country, My Life in Politics and History. And 12 years prior to that exchange with Trump, you had one of the most memorable exchanges for an interviewer and a political figure, former Georgia Governor Zell Miller in 2004, challenged you to a duel famously. What prompted that, Chris?
Yeah, I call that the miracle on 34th Street, like in the movie. I was at 34th and Broadway in New York in the Medial Strip, which is the Herald Square monument there, and right across from Macy's. And he was on the big screen in front of me coming from the Republican convention. He's a Democrat, and he had just given the keynote address and really lambasted the Democrats and said that the only defense programs they were going to support was to fight the enemy with spitballs. So I challenged him on that. I said, why did you say the Democrats, like John Kerry, only want to use spitballs against our enemies? And he goes, that's a metaphor. And I said, a metaphor for what? What's a spitball metaphor for? What are you talking about? You're saying Democrats are leaving us defenseless? And he goes, and he gets really mad at me. And he said, I wish I could come up there and be under your face or into your face. And then he goes, I wish it was a time a man could challenge another man to a duel. Well, my producers are my president of my network is in my ear. Keep them on. Don't.
Okay, we do have to take a break. It'll be a short one, and we'll get Chris Matthews to finish this amazing story about Zell Miller back after this timeout. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Your number is 877-217-5757. We're slated to rejoin Christopher John Matthews, the 20-year host of Hardball, left MSNBC recently, and we had a shaky phone line, as you could probably detect, when we had him a few moments ago, and we're trying to correct that, and hopefully we can, and Matt Doyle is doing his best to make sure that we can hear Chris Matthews loudly and clearly, and I think we've got Chris Matthews ready to go. And as we hit the break, Chris, you were in full bloom about this exchange, a memorable one. Arnold Schwarzenegger said you got $1 million in publicity, but it was uncomfortable being challenged by a public official to a duel on national television. But that's exactly what happened with former Governor Zell Miller. You were telling us about how it began with you questioning Miller's comments about John Kerry, and then it just kind of intensified after that. And in your ear, you've got your producer egging you on. What exactly happened?
Well, you know, it's like it reminded me of one of those police stories where there's a kidnapping or something, and they're trying to keep the bad guy on the line so they can trace the call. And the president of my network, Rick Kaplan, said, keep him on, savor it, savor it. He wanted, because there's a weird thing where one network has got something really exciting happening, and somehow through symbiosis or whatever you call it, people watching other networks can somehow tell that something's interesting happening on another network, and they flick to it. And so he was trying to get the ratings up, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, this guy's for real. After it was over, I told all my people working for me, I said, cool it. Don't talk about this to anybody. This guy may be serious. I don't want to be Alexander Hamilton, you know, on the banks of the Hudson River with two Confederate dueling pistols presented to me. I'm not going to do that. It was serious. It was a very strange moment. And if you looked at the guy, if you go back and look at the tapes, the look in the eye of Senator Miller was dead serious. And all I can tell you is right before he died, I wrote him a note and said, I think we all know what it's like to have a bad night, and it didn't make either of us look so great. So I wish you well. You're a great patriot. He'd been in the Marines, and he'd served the country as governor. And I just felt that he probably didn't like the liberals he dealt with in the U.S. Senate. They probably looked down their nose at him. And I think he had a real attitude about the people he was working with in the Democratic Party, the liberals.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wrote me a beautiful letter back, and I'm so glad I did that we got together at the end.
Yeah, I remember he supported Bill Clinton for president in 92, and ultimately he had an epiphany. And speaking of those, many probably are unaware, but you write about it in this book, This Country, from Chris Matthews. But when you went to Holy Cross as a young man, that's the College of the Holy Cross, you had a framed photo of Barry Goldwater in your suitcase. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did. Well, I can only claim the fact that Hillary Clinton was much like that. We grew up in Republican families, and I was gung-ho. And I loved, just like she did, I loved the libertarian aspect of Goldwater. It was basically, leave me alone. It was more like, too much government, too much bureaucracy. Let us be Americans again and live our own lives. And I think that was that's what I liked about Goldwater, true freedom. He loved that word freedom. He's a real cowboy. Arizona, you know, and I changed over time about civil rights, the Vietnam War, a lot of things. Social Security, my dad would correct me and say, well, this libertarian thing can only go so far, because if people don't save any money when they're working, and most people don't, you've got to have Social Security for people that don't have anything when they're 65. Mm-hmm. And just some common sense argument turned me away from this libertarian view of things.
Well, Chris Matthews was affected, as we all were, but he was one who was there and knows the reverence of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. But you also, some may not realize, but it is mentioned in the book more than a few times, you were a Capitol Police officer at one point.
When I came back from the Peace Corps in Africa, I didn't know anybody, but I wanted to get into politics. I wanted to be a speechwriter for a president. I knew that was my dream. I wanted to be like Ted Sorensen was for Jack Kennedy. And I knocked on doors. I knocked on about a couple hundred doors, and I finally got a job with a senator from Utah whose top guy said, I can't give you a job right away, but why don't you work as a Capitol policeman at night and work in the office during the daytime? So I was double shifting. I was working in the office answering complicated mail and stuff like that, and trying to learn how to write a good speech. And then I go over and put on my police uniform and my gun, my 38 Special, at 3 o'clock and worked until 11 o'clock at night as a police officer. And so I was there during a lot of the trouble, big demonstrations, for example, against the Vietnam War. It's ironic because I was against the war, and one of my friends from Africa in the Peace Corps actually was in one of the demonstrations. But it was interesting.
Well, and that was, of course, Goldwater was a nominee in 64, months after President Kennedy was assassinated, the first Catholic U.S. president. The second one's in office now, and you being a Catholic son of Philadelphia, I'm sure your family and you in particular were affected immensely by the assassination of JFK, a man you've written about quite prolifically through the years.
Yeah, I think it was a huge impact on my life. And I don't think people, younger people that didn't live through that would... You know, you have a big fight for president, a very close fight between two qualified people, Nixon and Kennedy. And one guy wins narrowly, and he becomes a great president, and he takes us through so much, especially the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, where we were really on the verge of a nuclear war. And he got us through it, and enormously glamorous character, and his wife, of course, and all of a sudden, in one afternoon, on a Friday afternoon, I get the word Holy Cross when I'm checking my mail. Kennedy's been shot. And I race over to, I have to go to my world history class. And then the professor said, well, you don't have to take a cut. You only allowed 3 cuts a semester, but you can take a cut. You don't have to take a cut. Just go. So some of the guys stayed in class. I couldn't believe that. I went over to the basement and found a TV set. And watched Walter Cronkite all afternoon talking about it. But in one moment, really, a president doesn't exist anymore. And the person we fought, that we elected, who was such a focus of our lives, was gone. And it made you think, well, democracy picks who we want as president, but it doesn't guarantee who's going to be president. Just because we pick him and he gets sworn in doesn't mean he'll be president. It's just a shattering reality.
You have written...
I don't think we got over it.
You have written charitably about Richard Nixon, the subject of other books by Chris Matthews, and mentioned more than Donald Trump in the latest book. And for those who vilify him for good reason, unlike Trump, he fought in a war for the United States, and unlike Trump, he conceded an election that he could have contested. Has Trump managed to make Richard Nixon look good?
Well, in that regard, yes, because when Nixon lost the election in 1960 by a hair, it was 33 million to 33 million, basically within 100,000, it turned out. There were real questions about Chicago and Richard Daley, especially with his comment to Kennedy that with the help of a few good friends, we're going to carry Illinois. I mean, Ben Bradley thought that meant mob. The editor of the Washington Post, who overheard that conversation, there was no Republican Party in Texas, so there's no vote watchers, there's no vote real count, there was no recall, there's no recount provision in the state constitution. There was no way to deal with what looked to be like Lyndon Johnson up to his old tricks. back when Jack Kennedy referred to him as landslide, because it was highly questioned about how he won in the first place to the Senate. So, you know, Nixon had reason to believe that it might have been stolen from him, but he also knew it would be very, very hard, in fact, impossible to get a serious recount going. And he knew it would just upset the whole country. He looked like a bad loser and everything. So when Kennedy called him up and said, let's get together, he said, sure. And they sat down together drinking Cokes at the Key Biscayne Hotel at a little villa outside it along the beach. And all of the press were there and everybody, the TV cameras, and it was, he was basically certified the election. He made it clear Kennedy had won and he had lost, and the country was united about it. I think that's something that shows patriotic instinct, a concern about the Cold War at the time. We didn't want to be a divided country without a president in the midst of the worst part of the Cold War. So think about it. We just got, you know, the Soviet Union was looked like they were catching up to us, if not surpassing us in power at that point in the Cold War. And he did the right thing. And I think, yeah, I'll give him credit for that. And I think even Ted Kennedy, after Nixon died, he made a big point of saying, this is Ted Kennedy that Nixon did that was, needs to be credited with what he did, the way he handled the defeat in 1960. Trump did the opposite. Trump is still talking about being reinstated this August, which I think is going to lead to more trouble. I mean, why wouldn't it be? January 6th was trouble. He's out saying, I'm going to be reinstated as president. Well, what happens when he's not reinstated, which he will not be? What will his followers be led to do? Who knows?
Well, lastly, Chris, you say your best job, and you've had some good ones, your best job was working for Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, I think it's hard to think about anything better than being on Air Force One, flying around, even in the old plane, where those Air Force pilots could take off at 45 degrees, like they go right up. And going from stop to stop on a campaign trail, and you're writing on an old electric typewriter, and you're knocking out. And I can imagine, I can see the picture right now. I'm knocking out stuff for the next stop, and with the President of the United States reading my words, I just don't think there's anything better than that in politics. And I loved it. I absolutely. And even back on the White House, when I'd be knocking out speeches in my office, in the old executive office building. I mean. And going to lunch and talking to the other staffers about what's going on at the round table. When you're a young guy, that's the most amazing job in the world, I think.
Well, Chris Matthews writes about it all, and he has had quite a life in politics. This Country is the book from Chris. Thank you for joining us, Chris. I'm glad you're remaining in the game. You're one of the best ever. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. This is a wonderful interview, sir. Thank you very much for having me on.
We're back after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. We head down the home stretch with Tyler Pager, White House reporter for the Washington Post. Tyler is a prolific writer, joining the paper in 2021, as in this year, after covering the White House at Politico and the 2020 presidential campaign at Bloomberg News. He graduated valedictorian from the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. He served as the editor-in-chief of the Daily Northwestern and also graduated with distinction from the University of Oxford, where he earned a master's degree in social policy. And good morning to you, Tyler Pager.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to talk with you. Now, were you a Rhodes Scholar, Tyler?
I was not.
So you went to Oxford kind of like our John Kennedy did, the U.S. Senator from Louisiana. And I imagine...
Yeah, it was a great experience.
Even though you weren't a Rhodes Scholar, you have to have pretty good grades and have to be pretty smart to get into Oxford. But you're covering the White House now, and it is a different world with President Biden. You say he came to office with an abiding belief in the potency of symbols and the ability of a president's utterances to influence not just policy, but the course of a nation. How is he doing that?
Yeah, I think that's something that the administration has been trying to do because it's something that Biden himself is really invested in, which is this idea that the words and actions of a president matter beyond just the policy that he can sign and pass into law, that he sets an example for the direction of the country that he wants to go in. And so we've seen that take place we saw that take place as a candidate, but as he became president, the type of events and he's had and the people he's invited to the White House are elevated, have been part of a larger message that he's trying to send. So I think one of the most striking examples of that is when he went to Tulsa on the anniversary of the massacre there 100 years. He was the first president to go there for that type of event and gave a speech connecting, you know, the history of this racist massacre to the continuing struggle for civil rights, whether that's voting rights or, you know, policy that tries to address racial disparities. You know, that kind of symbolism of being in Tulsa on the 100th anniversary and connecting that to policy, that's been an intentional effort by the president and his team.
Now, you have been following the president with Ernest, and he was in Helsinki and went toe-to-toe with Vladimir Putin. And how did he fare?
Yeah, so it was Trump that was in Helsinki and Biden that was in Geneva.
Okay, forgive me, you are correct. Thank
no,
you.
No, it's very similar, very similar setup, but I think the approach was quite different. And I think, you know, Biden has been very clear that Russia is an adversary, has been quite critical of Putin and his regime. And I think, you know, the Biden administration, the White House, from their perspective, they feel the summit went well. You know, they celebrated, you know, his ability to go into this meeting with Putin and lay out their concerns and criticisms of his regime, whether that's the hacking and cyber warfare that we've seen impacting American infrastructure, election interference, human rights violations. I think so. That's the White House's perspective. I think if you look, you know, more broadly, we didn't necessarily see any clear deliverables. I mean, the smallest thing that they could do, which they did do, was they're returning their ambassadors to the capital cities. So I think that's one step in trying to lower the tension between these two nations. But in terms of trying to make progress, Putin gave a press conference where he didn't even take responsibility or ownership of the hacking that has impacted American gas lines or American meatpacking plants, or, you know, didn't even name Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader who is in jail. And so I think it just shows how wide the gulf remains and how much work needs to be done between the U.S. and Russia.
It is remarkable how in the United States the summit, if that's the right word, in Geneva is portrayed. If you watch Fox News, Biden was an adult and just failed miserably. And then Putin, in his own words, praised President Biden. Now, obviously, Putin has ulterior motives, but it appeared that Biden fared better than the previous president did in Helsinki when he all but absolved Vladimir Putin from interfering in the 2016 election. Your thoughts about how the two compare, Biden in Geneva and Trump in Helsinki, with the same guy, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that is a very interesting part of the two is just the different ways that they were received. And I think particularly to your point about what Putin said about Biden, I think is really striking. You know, there's been this concerted effort from Republicans to say that Biden is, you know, in mental decline, he's not sharp. You know, there was just a letter from more than a dozen Republicans calling for Biden to submit to a mental acuity test. And Putin said quite the opposite, that, you know, those reports or those depictions of Biden are just not accurate. And I think that is quite striking. But in terms of the difference, I think the biggest one, obviously, is, you know, Trump absolved, as you said, Putin of election interference. Biden did not do that. From all reports about how the meeting went, Biden was pretty firm about concerns that the U.S. has with Russia. I think one of the differences, obviously, is we did not see them stand side by side and do a press conference together. Putin and Trump did one, and that's where you kind of saw Trump acquiescing to Putin a little bit more. Biden and Putin did separate press conferences, so they each got to share their own story without standing next to each other. And I think that does make some difference, but the approach was just dramatically different from the two American presidents.
Jason, in Mid-City, wants your take, Tyler Pager, on yesterday's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court fending off a third attempt to scrap the Affordable Care Act, and this time it was a 7-2 ruling, not 5-4. And even Clarence Thomas voted in the majority. What is your take on whether this is a substantial move by the high court?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just shows the evolution on this issue of the Affordable Care Act, right? As you mentioned, it's been progressively the three cases, each time more justices have sided with the ACA and really enshrining this landmark health care law by President Obama as the law of the land. And I think it now opens up a new era in terms of how both Democrats and Republicans will message around this issue. This has been a rallying cry for both parties at different times in the law's history. You know, in 2010, this was a huge boon for the ushering of the Tea Party and the Republican conservative movement. Railing against the ACA in the 2018 midterms, the Democrats ran on a message of the Affordable Care Act needs to remain the law of the land and usher in a Democratic majority in the House. So you think it shows how evolved this issue has become and how it's now going to change as the parties think about talking about health care. That is a dramatic change in the way that this healthcare law has been perceived and ruled on by the court in just the last decade. And I think that just shows how much it's become part of the fabric of the American political system.
Now, a listener asked about a story you wrote a few days ago last week about the president, the current one, Joseph Robinette Biden, conferring with none other than Albert Gore about this infrastructure bill. And the former vice president, who, as we know, came within a vote of being the U.S. president, he is encouraging, exhorting, cajoling, if you will, the current president to stick to his guns about having climate plans as part of the infrastructure deal. What's going on?
Yeah, so this has been a point of contention from progressives in the Democratic Party, particularly those who are very invested in issues of climate change. Obviously, Biden is very interested in trying to get a bipartisan infrastructure deal. He wants to, figure out a way to get at least 10 Republicans to vote for a slimmed-down version of his massive infrastructure package that he proposed a few months ago. And in those negotiations with Republicans, there are progressive Democrats that are quite concerned that some of the more robust climate provisions may fall out of the package. And so the story that we wrote was about this ongoing effort from outside the White House to lobby the administration to ensure that there is still robust climate initiatives in there. They feel that part of rebuilding the nation's infrastructure, the United States should take a more concerted effort to ensuring that it is green infrastructure and environmentally friendly to combat climate change. And so that Al Gore call was part of a larger effort from climate activists to pressure and lobby Joe Biden to ensure that any sort of negotiations don't slim back some of the climate provisions that he initially proposed.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Tyler Pager, Washington Post, young guy who's going to be around for a while. Remember the name. Today is the 68th anniversary of the Baton Rouge bus boycott. It lasted 8 days before the city, eager to stem red ink, reached a compromise with its leaders. It set aside a few seats at the front of the city buses for white passengers and a long bench seat in the back for black passengers, and the seats in between would be for everyone. This was 2.5 years before Rosa Parks in Montgomery, and the lady who did not give up her seat, Martha White, died a few days ago right here in Baton Rouge, 99 years old, black housekeeper, bone-weary from coming home from work one day in 1953, and as she climbed aboard a city bus, she saw only one seat left in the whites-only section at the front. She took it and would not let it go and created a place in history, a protest that became a template for Martin Luther King, Jr., Happy Juneteenth. Until Monday, for Matt Doyle, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. Be safe and stay tuned.